Hello, Professor Blackburn. Thank you for accepting my invitation.
Hello, Teddy, isn't it?
Yeah. People call me Teddy.
Okay, hello, Teddy.
I want to start by discussing your book, Think. Most high schoolers who consider applying to university to read philosophy are encouraged to read your popular book called Think. I read it when I was pondering whether to study philosophy, and I regard it as one of the best introductions to the subject. So what motivated you to write that book?
Oh, what motivated me? I suppose I'd written the Oxford Dictionary of Philosophy. That was in the mid-1990s. And so I began to think what to do next. And I've always tried to, many years, I've tried to keep a teaching role as well as a research role. So I have written papers for many collections and the journals and so on. But I've also written books like Think or Being Good, some books on truth, which were designed to help people into difficult subjects. And I found I enjoy doing that very much. I've always been a teacher, and it gives me great pleasure when I can manage to say something that, you know, introduces people to a new way of thinking, a new topic, a new set of skills. And so it was a fairly natural thing for me to try to write an introductory book of that kind. I think it's hadn't been, I don't want to boast, but I don't think it had been well done since Russell's Problems of Philosophy, which was written in 1912. So
right.
the market seemed open, and indeed it proved to be, yeah.
You also mentioned your book, Being Good. I also have it here. We'll discuss it in a few moments.
Yes.
But I want to discuss philosophy more generally. So for most subjects X, there is a philosophy of X. We have philosophy of science, philosophy of language, mathematics, and so on. But for the time being, I want to make philosophy itself as our object of discourse. What would you say the role of philosophy is in the contemporary intellectual landscape?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that it's not as foremost, it's not as important as it ought to be. I think a lot of people who think they've got beyond philosophy just do it badly, or are in the grip of ideas which need interrogation and clarification. So I think there's too little philosophy in the academy, and that includes many universities, let alone the way politicians think about what's worth studying and concentrate on STEM subjects, you know, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. And that's fine. I mean, those are important subjects. But I think it's also important to reflect on our ways of thought, the concepts which we use to guide our lives. And that's what philosophy tries to do. Philosophy always comes when you go one step up the ladder, as it were, when you get off the ground that you're familiar with and start wondering about its credentials or its clarity or what it means, what it leaves unclear, whether there are better ways of thinking. So that's how I think of philosophy. And then whether that's worth doing, well, it's worth doing well. Whether it's worth doing in some of the ways it gets done is doubtful. And of course, we philosophers quarrel with each other about whether particular methodologies are suitable or the only ones or important ones. So an important kind of philosophical debate is also often very much partly a meta-philosophical debate, a debate about method and approach and what's likely to be valuable and what isn't.
But yet, you mentioned the STEM subjects. Some people say that there's a difference between those subjects and philosophy because they sort of accuse philosophy of making no progress. Do you share these sentiments?
I think let's look at some partners in crime. Does literature make progress? Do the arts make progress? Does music make progress? All these subjects change, and it's very important for each generation to build on what it sees to be of value in its predecessors, but then to effect that change. So philosophy has changed throughout the centuries, obviously. Nobody is going to at least I hope nobody is going to look to Aristotle for biological wisdom. He was a very good biologist for his day, but his day has passed. Politics has moved on since Plato, I think, although Plato still has things to teach us. And of course, since the scientific revolution of the 17th century, philosophy has changed unrecognizably, I would say. I mean, it's a different subject now. It's a different subject now from it was when I studied it at school, actually, or at university.
To play the devil's advocate a bit further, you mentioned, has music made any progress or literature made any progress, but they are not concerned with answering some questions, are they? I mean, even though philosophy has changed throughout the history, we still have the ancient questions with us, such as, I don't know, what is good, what is truth? We'll talk about this in a minute more in depth. Yeah, sure. So I don't know whether the comparison with entertainment such as literature and music does actually answer the skeptic's question if he's stubborn enough.
Well, if he's stubborn enough, I agree that he might insist that philosophy's got to be like mathematics or physics or biology, or it's nothing. But I think that's already imposing a philosophy of philosophy.
Right.
I think philosophy, after all, it's often continuous with subjects like history or literature. And they're not so wedded to a self-image of answering questions with finality. They're more wedded to a separate to an image of drawing a new picture, of drawing a new interpretation out, of reinterpreting a tradition or a set of events. And I think that concept of reinterpretation is a fruitful one for philosophy to employ here. We put a new slant on things, and sometimes that slant is illuminating. People who adopt it find that it helps, that puzzles have gone away. And then it's a question of convincing other people that that's true.
Standardly, the goal of philosophical inquiry is to sort of put our finger on various truths about the world. But however, this notion of truth is notoriously difficult and has generated lengthy debates. So can you please tell us what the standard theories of truth are and which one do you empathize the most with?
Well, the standards are very difficult, and it's going to depend on the subject matter. The subject matter often imposes its own standards. So, you know, if the question is whether there's whether there's a planet in the solar system which is more than 6,000 miles in diameter, then there are astronomical methods which will tell you whether that's true or false, and they provide the standard. When the topic is whether it's good that children should be taught to obey their parents, then the standards are not so obvious, because people can legitimately argue that it is good that they're taught to obey their parents, because that way there's family harmony and there's respect all around and various things like that. And other people can legitimately argue that it's not good that they're taught to obey their parents, because that turns them into unimaginative zombie-like figures who just go about being obedient, and that's a sort of brave new world that we don't want. So there are aspects, different aspects to a moral situation like that. And some people may choose to stress one and some may choose to stress the other. And that's when the notion of truth, or there being one truth, starts to sort of wobble under people. They start thinking, well, maybe there's just these two different ways of looking at human life, and we can't really claim that one is better than the other. But you've got to try it before you get to that pessimistic conclusion, I think.
Right, but those are discussions about how do we determine truth. I mean, how do we conduct those astronomical measures, and or how what criteria do we use for our moral judgments?
Yes.
But I was mostly interested in the philosophical investigations of the notion of truth itself. I mean, ranging from the correspondence theory to all the classic ones in the literature.
Right. It's no accident that I pushed it back to the The question of what you're interested in and the method for settling it, or whether there's not a method for settling it. Because I'm actually what they call a deflationist about truth. And a deflationist flies under the banner of saying that there isn't really a substantive question left. There's no substantive question about what truth is that we should trouble our heads with. Often, perhaps typically, it just comes out as a badge of agreement. If you say something and I say that's true, that's really just an expression of agreement that I'm prepared to sign up to that belief or that opinion as well. If I say that's not true, that's an expression of disagreement. I'm not prepared to sign up to that. And then the causes or reasons why people sign up to one thing or another, well, that's often lost in their psychologies, their upbringing, their environment, their knowledge. And of course, there are people with whom we disagree profoundly, and then we say, well, they've got the wrong end of the stick. They don't know the facts, they don't know what they're talking about. President Trump comes to mind. That's a sign of disagreement. But of course, there's not very much to say about agreement and disagreement per se. You have to go back to the topic that we're talking about and then thrash out the arguments and see what the evidence is and how it points and so on. So my stance on truth is there's not nearly as much to say about it as correspondence theorists, coherence theorists, pragmatist theorists hoped or wanted to find. They thought that there was going to be something that all true propositions had in common. Just as we think there's something that, say, all conscious beings have in common. Being conscious is a property, a very difficult one to understand, but we hope that there's something there that, if only we could get our fingers on it, which would separate things that are conscious, might include some higher animals, might include some fish, I don't know, certainly includes all normal human beings. So that's a property, and it's we try to investigate it. It's a very difficult philosophical problem. But with truth, it's another different thing to say there's some property that all true beliefs share, or some property that all true propositions share, some property that all truths share, because truths are very unlike one another. We think of all conscious beings as like one another in respect of consciousness. But truths, what's the commonality between the truth that the Earth is 4 billion years old and the truth that we're using Zoom? They're two different truths from different kinds of subject matter. We think they're both true, at least I hope we do, but entirely different methodologies, entirely different aspects of our world that they're talking about. So the idea that there's a property in common has come under a lot of attack, and I sympathize with the attack. I think it's, and of course, in the background, there's the thought that attempts to say something substantive about truth have almost universally, I would say, crashed in flames. There is no, there are no history of battles fought and won by people trying to give substantive theories of truth.
Well, let's check one of them. Let's put one of them to the trial. I mean, yeah. What exactly do you reject about one of the theories that you mentioned, namely the correspondence theory? You mentioned a few sentences. We have some linguistic items, some strings of characters, and a correspondence theory would say that this corresponds to a fact that is out there in the world. Do you regard this as sort of a synonym for what truth is, or what exactly is your problem with it?
There's nothing at all wrong with saying that truth is correspondence with the fact. The question is whether there's anything illuminating about it. And philosophers, including, for example, Quine, the great American philosopher, Wittgenstein, Ramsey, Frege, you know, the whole roll call of the great philosophers of the 20th century, have said, no, you can say that truth is correspondence of the facts, fine, don't deny it, but don't think it offers you any illumination. Now, the reason it doesn't offer any illumination is that facts are just as mysterious as truth.
Why?
A way I like to introduce this is with a remark of Wittgenstein's. Wittgenstein said that if you take some nice big structure like the Eiffel Tower, it's got a position in the world and you can move it about. The French were lucky that Hitler didn't try to move the Eiffel Tower to Berlin, but he could have, and then it would have been in Berlin. But you can't move the fact that the Eiffel Tower is in Paris anywhere. It doesn't have a location, the fact. It just sits there with the Eiffel Tower being in Paris. And if you move the Eiffel Tower, then there's no longer any fact that it's in Paris. The point is, a fact is not like a chunky, substantial bit of reality that you can put in your pocket or that you could weigh or see or come across just by use of the senses. Facts don't impinge on you causally. Facts are mental constructions. I mentioned Quine, and Quine's great remark about this was that facts are fictions. They're constructions simply invented as something to have truth to correspond to. So people felt a need for something that relates to sentences in the way that I relate to Simon or you relate to Theodore, that is references. And so since sentences don't actually have references, we invented facts for true sentences to refer to. But that's, as it were, running on the spot. It's not finding some new item in the furniture of the world, as is shown by the fact they have no locations and can't be moved.
Still, people seem to be comfortable talking about facts. I mean, this is a common word in their vocabulary. And even though they are not concrete objects, they don't have a spatiotemporal location and we can't move facts, this is also true about numbers. I mean, we can't move the number 2 and we talk about these things. And they are mysterious objects, but we assume that they exist. So why can't the tables be turned and we should, I don't know, accept the reality of facts as abstract objects and then check whether this theory still holds or not?
Well, your comparison's a very good one. But of course, it's been a matter of great controversy whether we gain anything by thinking of numbers as things or whether they are reifications of adjectives. I mean, the great insight that Frege had when he started the foundations of arithmetic, his great book, was that a number term, like a numeral like 2, 3, is fundamentally an adjective. It describes the magnitude or the multitude. The size of a multitude is given by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And it's not obvious why you gain anything by turning those adjectives into nouns. It's when they become nouns that you start thinking of numbers as things. In the first part of his book, Frege argued that that was a mistake. And I think he was right. And I think it's a pity that he's kind of complicated his position. So the philosophy of mathematics has struggled with it ever since. But I actually think that rather than thinking of numbers and facts as mysterious kinds of things, I think it's best not to think of them as things at all.
You said that you're a deflationist after dismissing the classical theories of truth, but all of the theories of truth are sort of threatened by what is known as the semantic paradoxes in the literature, typically centered as what is known as the liar's paradox.
Yes.
Can you please tell us what is the liar's sentence? Why does it haunt our inquiries? And what is your take on it?
Yes, well, this is getting me onto very difficult ground, and ground I'm not very sure about, because I've never looked at it as a research topic, and I know the literature has become very, very involved and dense, so it's very difficult. But that said, I'd say this: the problem with the liar is you've got a sentence, and in our normal understanding of it, it's got the horrific property that if it's true, it's false, and if it's false, it's true. The sentence, you can take any number of them, but one of them would be, I'm currently speaking falsely. Well, if that's true, then when I said it, I was speaking falsely. So if it's true, it's false. And if it's false, I'm not speaking falsely, but since I'm speaking, then I must be speaking truly. So if it's false, if it's true, it's false. Sorry, if it's true, it's false, and if it's false, it's true.
Right.
Now that sounds just like a trick. It was Epimenides the Cretan was supposed to have said all Cretans are liars, and so then the paradox strikes. It sounds like just a trick. You'd think it would be quite easy to solve it. And people have suggested various principles for solving it. One principle, for example, would be that you might disallow any sentence from describing itself. That's a sort of self-reference, a sort of circle. Maybe if we allow that, it's because we allow that we get into difficulty. So you could adopt the principle, we don't allow sentences to refer to themselves. But that sounds, you know, there are lots of cases where a sentence can refer to itself. If I said all the English sentences we can understand are less than 5,000 words long, that's a sentence which falls within its own embrace. It's less than 5,000 words long, it's an English sentence, and you can understand it.
Yes.
So it's an example of all English sentences you can understand are less than 5,000 words long. And if somebody said, oh, we can't accept that, it doesn't mean anything because it refers to itself, they'd say, hey, no, I can understand it perfectly well. So it seems as though there's something, got to be something more special about the liar than that you've just got a sentence that refers to itself.
And obviously, the logician Kurt Gödel showed that there's absolutely no problem with self-reference in mathematical frameworks.
Yes, yes, I think that's a good way of putting what Gödel did show. But again, it irritates people. I mean, Gödel's result is, I think, unimpeachable. It was a mathematical proof of a mathematical theorem. The device by which he did it is puzzling. And people have looked at the proof and wondered whether there isn't a concealed problem with it. I don't think there is. I think it's a perfectly straightforward proof. But it's certainly, the self-reference element is perplexing enough to raise red flags for some people. Just to go one step further, the next thing you might say about the liar or try to say is, well, maybe the sentence is meaningless.
Right.
And that might seem to be, you know, there's something queer about the sentence. So perhaps we might say it doesn't actually succeed in meaning anything. But then the problem is you get so-called strengthened liar or the revenge liar. Because you come and you get an example of the liar which says, this sentence is either false or meaningless. And you can get a paradox out of that as well. That's then if it's true, it's either false or meaningless. And if it's false, then it's neither false nor meaningless, then it's true. So you get another version of the liar, which proves just as difficult to solve as the first. And this is going to be a nasty thing, the so-called revenge liar, which lies in the way of almost any approach you can think of to the liar. So it's a very, very perplexing thing. Myself, I think that an approach given originally, I think, by Gilbert Ryle has some mileage. And this is to say that the sentence is not necessarily meaningless, that's too strong, but it lacks a content because there is no actual proposition identified, which is then capable of being either true or false. And then you lay the charge at the idea of sentences being themselves bearers of truth and falsity. That's rather perplexing. I don't know whether your audience is going to get lost at this. But Ryle put it nicely in terms of namely. So suppose we say this sentence, namely that this sentence is true. This sentence, namely that this sentence is false, is true or false. You then say, well, hang on, the namely isn't telling me the content. It's not succeeding in identifying what the sentence we're supposed to be talking about actually says. So it's as if it goes on forever, namely that, namely that, namely that. And this is Ryle's argument that doesn't actually succeed in issuing in a determinate proposition. And I think there's something to be said along those lines. You mustn't say it's meaningless. I don't think it is. But I think you can have meaningful sentences that don't identify determinate propositions.
Right.
A good example would be, suppose you're hidden from somebody in a next door hotel room, and you hear whoever's in the hotel room say, this is a particularly nice one. Well, you think, well, he must have said something. I don't know what he was referring to, so I'm not quite sure what he said, but he must have said something. It's a perfectly good English sentence. And you wonder what it is that's a particularly nice one, and so on. Now, it may be that he was just practicing. He wasn't actually pointing to anything. He was practicing some speech or something. In which case, his sentence, this isn't especially nice one, doesn't actually succeed in, it doesn't have any content. It can't be either true or false because the this has no reference. And Ryle's attempt was to say that the liar lives in something like that, that unfortunate state. It's a state where it sounds like a good sentence, but it isn't really.
I think to make the topics a bit more well suited for audiences that might have gotten lost in discussions,
yes,
about logic.
I know. The liar is a nasty thing.
It is, but I had to mention it because it's very important to the subject itself.
Yeah,
let's
discuss
some ideas in this nice little book,
sure.
Being good. You start this book by addressing or dismissing some of the usual attacks that are leveled against the enterprise of ethics. So,
yes.
If you want to, let's discuss some of them. Famous Christian apologists such as William Lane Craig insist that without God, there would be no objective moral facts, giving the impression that everything would be permitted without divine laws. However, the first chapter of your book is called The Death of God. So can you please explain your title choice and your views on the relationship between religion and morality?
Yes. I've never for a moment thought that if God is dead, everything is permitted. And so I took the opportunity to attack that view. A theological basis for ethics is much stranger than it sounds. And even people who believe in God don't necessarily believe that God provides the foundation for morality. And the reason was that the reason was discovered, you might say, by Plato, a long time ago, in a diary called the Euthyphro. and ignoring the trappings of the dialogue, although it's a sort of dramatic story that Plato tells, it comes to this. When we say that something's good or enjoined by God, is it enjoined by God because it's good, or is it good because it's enjoined by God? Which way round does the explanation go? Now, if you say, well, it's God's will because it's good, then you're involved with some alternative, some background fact making it good, some background aspect of the thing that God has latched onto. Good for God, we say, but he is not then acting as the foundation. He's just a signal that the thing is good. So suppose you say, no, it wouldn't have been good if God hadn't chosen it or commanded it or somehow valorized it, he's put his thumb on it. Then what could be meant by saying that God is good? And yet Christians want to say that God's good. But that would be a tautology then, because if whatever God chooses or recommends is good just because he chooses or recommends it, then there can't be anything especially good about his taste or his ethics, because
it's arbitrary.
There's no chance of him going wrong, so it's arbitrary.
Yep.
So the attempt to provide a theological foundation for ethics is often supposed to have just crashed at the first hurdle, at the hurdle that Plato put in front of it. People like William Lane Craig have nothing, I don't think they've got any idea what he's talking about. And the other thing about it is that in practice, people who think that their religion underlies their ethics have a distorted view of ethics, because basically they have what the philosopher Bernard Williams nicely called one thought too many. So for example, suppose I'm minded to be nice to my children, and somebody says, oh, you're a good father, Simon, that's very nice. And I think, yeah, well, if it hadn't been for God, that wouldn't have been a good thing to do. That's terrible. It was a nice thing to do because of the children and my relationship to them. End of story. God has nothing to do with it. For all I know, God might have commanded me to be horrible to my children so they grow up independent and so on. But I'm not thinking about that. I just think, you know, here's my children. I must be nice to them. So the one thought too many is that you can, for the theologically minded person, you don't get good behavior between two human beings. You only get good behavior between two human beings and God. So it's like having God in bed with you all the time, and that doesn't make for a good relationship.
So the thought is that you are not a good person just because you're acting out of being afraid of eternal damnation.
Well, if it's a fear of eternal damnation, then clearly, yeah. I mean, that's several thoughts too many. I mean, if I thought my wife kisses me because she's afraid of eternal damnation, then that's a terrible marriage. You want your wife to kiss you because she likes kissing you.
You mentioned another threat to ethics, and that is quite famous over the internet in the philosophical circles, and that is the problem of free will. So a famous attack on moral responsibility comes from science, sometimes from physics, sometimes from biology, sometimes from neuroscience. But in your book, you defend free will against challenges from genetics. So can you please say why we can still be held morally responsible in spite of our genetic baggage, and whether your reply is applicable to deterministic attacks from physics or neuroscience?
Good. Yes, I mean, that's in fact, there's a new edition of that book coming out next year.
Oh,
and
okay.
When I wrote it in the late 90s, the idea of genetic determinism was much more common. There was a kind of biology-inspired pessimism about human nature. You see this in Richard Dawkins, the selfish gene. And you see it in many people. I forget if I quoted in that book a biologist, Gieselin, who said that, you know, there's no such thing as altruism, scratch a human animal, you find that genetics has made us into, or Darwin's evolutionary processes have made us into the nasty animals that we really are underneath. Everything else is just flim-flam, it's just a veneer or pretense. And so this was a much more common view in those days. It's been exploded since people like E.O. Wilson and Elliot Sober have written excellent biology books, which show there was never any excuse for interpreting Darwin in that way. Nature is full of symbiotic behavior, behavior of creatures that can only live together and therefore accommodate to each other. And we just conform to that pattern. So I think now you're right that in the present climate, it would be much more common to cite physical causation, chemical or neurophysiology of the brain as the machine that makes us do what we do, and hence there's no such thing as free will. So yes, I need to alter that in a subsequent edition.
Can you give us a summary of your reply?
Yes, my reply is quite like that of Sir Peter Strawson in a very, very famous essay called Freedom and Resentment, which the people who talk about this on the web ought really to read and try and digest. And Strawson pointed out that however we think about determinism, ourselves as being causally determined by events in our brains or in our environment and our brains, we are going to exercise a difference between a reaction. If we think somebody did something deliberately with a motive and forethought and so on, and if we think they did it through accident. So there's all the difference in the world, to me, between somebody stepping on my foot accidentally on the tube train, say. That could happen to anyone. The train rocks, you lose your balance, you know, you don't know where your foot's going. And somebody deliberately treading on my foot, aiming at my foot and succeeding in treading on it because they want to hurt me or they want to, or they've got some other strategy or plan. So whether we think of people's behaviors as emanating from their decisions, that's important to us. Now, the question is, what's deciding?
Yes.
Well, whatever it is, and no doubt it's involves cortical activities, which not deciding doesn't involve. When you decide things, they're going to be areas of your brain that are involved in doing things like assessing alternatives, thinking of costs and benefits, thinking of probabilities, rationalizing an action, and motivating you and seizing on your motivations and making you do it. Now, all that may be deterministic, but if its upshot is, as it were, criminal behavior, then I'm going to look at you very differently. I'm going to look at you as somebody who decides to do bad stuff. And I'm going to resent you for that if the bad stuff comes my way and affects me unjustly and so on. Then I'm going to resent you, I'm going to try and invoke social sanctions against you, I'm going to treat you as a criminal. Now the hard determinist, the person who thinks that determinism gets in the way of that, thinks that it's always wrong to treat somebody. patient agents. They're not in charge of their doings. They just think they're locus for things to happen. And I don't think that's true. I think we have to see people as agents. Sometimes we see them as patients. If you lie in bed at the temperature, I don't think that is the upshot of your decision-making. It was the upshot of things happening to you. You were a patient, you were passive in the face of some events. But if you go around pinching other people's belongings, I do think of that as the upshot of decisions. There may be, I don't say there are, but there may be genuine conditions called kleptomania, where in a sense you can't help it. But they're quite uncommon. And your ordinary criminal can't shelter behind the fact that they're determined to do it in this physiological sense. The thing is, they chose to do it, and they have to face up to the consequences of choosing to do it. Because it's when people's choosing and decisions have gone wrong that we resent them and blame them and so on. So there's that difference, Strawson argued, is one that you're never going to get past. You're never going to get a recognizably human life which pays no attention to whether a bad behavior was the upshot of decision-making and choice and conscious or even unconscious decision, and whether it was, in a sense, a happening, just something that by bad luck you stumbled into my way, or by bad luck your foot tread on mine on the bus or whatever. So I think the first thing to say about free will is you're not going to do without it. You're not going to live a life without it.
I'm not sure whether someone that insists hard enough on whether our very act of paying attention is not just a byproduct of things that are happening in the brain and we cannot help it. I mean, there are obvious cases where people are patients and they can't help what they do in their actions. But celebrities such as Sam Harris, which is not a professional philosopher, but he has an impact on the general public's opinion on these things, says that everyone is sort of a patient in some respect. And one of my problems with the questions which ask on whether we should hold someone accountable is that we seem to impose this ability of freedom on the judge. I have a problem with the judge. It seems as though the judge and the jury do have free will, and they're in a position to ponder about what they should do. So the judge is subject to the same deterministic attacks that people such as Harris would say. Do the question of moral responsibility and free will even make sense through these lenses, or is this comment misguided?
I don't see the force of the point that the judge is in the same boat as the criminal, let's say, because the judge is doing something which is, let's say, legitimate. It's his role in society to make sure we're safe from criminals or to express society's detestation of criminal behavior, and that's what he's doing. Now, of course, he's in some sense determined to do it, determined in the sense of caused to do it, just as the criminal was caused to behave badly. But the fact that the judge is behaving well and the criminal was behaving badly is what makes all the difference. That's what Strawson's point relies on, that we resent, we have these attitudes of rejection and resentment and disappointment and often despair faced with the bad behavior of people who choose to behave badly.
But again, what would Strawson say about the claim that those dispositions are illusory? I mean, they are just epiphenomenal.
Dispositions are not illusory. They're out there in the marketplace. You can see people trying to steal each other's goods.
I meant the very act of evaluating people according to whether they did something accidentally or not is just an illusion that the agent is conscious of only milliseconds after a Libet lag. After they happen in the brain, and they are not the authors of the judgments.
I don't think that Libet's gap makes any difference to this. You act when you act. The fact that your action is preceded by brain activity of a certain kind doesn't by itself impress me as something that releases you from being the author of your act. It doesn't mean that the act was going to happen anyhow. Sartre, who is a great defender of freedom, Jean-Paul Sartre, his whole existentialist philosophy was built around the idea of freedom. He said that when the time comes to act, the decision has already been made. In other words, that what we call a decision itself has a pedigree. It goes back a long way in the brain or in your environment or anything. You don't spring into action sort of formed out of dragon's teeth a millisecond ago. When you act, it's a creature with a language, a history, an upbringing, an environmental background, and of course a neurophysiological makeup, which is the result of all those factors. But still, it's you that act, and it's you that has to take the consequences, as we say. Now, the consequences needn't be punishment and imprisonment and so on. We can try and think of very humane ways of dealing with resentment, of expressing it and feeling that justice has been done. We don't have to be punitive, but it seems to me we do have to take account of the fact that people can be held properly responsible for their own actions. I'm a compatibilist, as they call it. I think that free will is compatible. Free will in the only sense worth having, as Dan Dennett put it, is compatible with determinism.
So in a way, it is physics and neuroscience would be the wrong level in which we should assess the questions concerning free will.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Exactly. I'm very glad that I've got a great big deterministic system in there propelling me along. Because if I didn't, I'd be rudderless, I'd be hopeless.
One of my last questions would be if there is any philosophers in history who had an impact on your thinking.
Oh, yes, quite a lot in different ways. I think the two philosophers I'm probably most closely identify myself with and think of myself as, in a sense, following them are Wittgenstein, or to some extent a lesser known philosopher, but one who influenced Wittgenstein a great deal, a man called Frank Ramsey, F.P. Ramsey, who was a Cambridge philosopher, very, very distinguished man who died before he was 27 years old, so he was a genius. And before that, two centuries before that, David Hume, the great Scottish philosopher. It seems to me, I can't read Hume's works on almost anything, especially on causation, on ethics, on political work, without a feeling of being led by the hand. You feel like a child in the grip of this magnificent intellect and command. I've always been under that spell, I think, nearly all my adult life. So if I could be hailed in heaven as a loyal disciple of Hume, I'd be very pleased.
What would you say is one of the important contributions of Hume to philosophy?
Oh gosh, I think he was the first modern naturalist. So, for example, when it came to things like the soul or personal identity, Hume's always trying to downplay it, to say it's not everything you think it is. Don't elevate it into a principle of difference with the rest of nature. When it comes to the ways we behave, he sources causally as part of the same sort of causal nexuses as everything else. He didn't allow us special kinds of intuition, an awareness of, to go back to where we started, an awareness of abstract objects like facts or numbers. He didn't countenance that kind of elevation above the rest of nature that was absolutely endemic to the Christian traditions, to the Aristotelian tradition. You know, that human beings are exceptional in being rational. We're like angels in being rational, in being different. And Hume cuts that all down to size. So I think he deserves his pedestal in Edinburgh, which he's got, of course. He deserves it because I think he was the first great naturalist. I mean, it's a shame that he died before Darwin. He died before a near contemporary of his, the great geologist James Hutton, showed that the forces that shape the Earth are just the forces we see every day around us, but acting over huge scales and huge differences. Principle of uniformitarianism in geology. But I think he would have just loved that. But he died too early.
It's quite impressive that Hume published his views before Darwin, because it seems as though he was anticipating Darwin.
Almost, yeah, absolutely, almost. Of course, there is scholarly interest in whether people did anticipate Darwin. It was the principle of natural selection, which was particular to Darwin. The idea of evolution was there in Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin. Was an evolutionist, but they had no idea of the mechanism of evolution. So you could still talk about God's guiding hand, whereas Darwin gives you the mechanism. And Hume, he came very close to it in the Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, which is the funniest philosophy book that's ever been written, and also one of the most instructive. And he points out that it's no miracle that animals do what they're good at doing. That is, that their natures are such that they eat X and then they go and look for X and they're adapted. So he's got the idea of adaptation. And once you have that, then you're three quarters of the way, I think, to the idea of a species evolving in accordance with changes which lead to different adaptations being successful. And that's the principle of natural selection.
Thank you for your time, Professor Blackburn. It was a pleasure talking to you and discussing your work.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Have a good day.
Bye. Bye-bye.